Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and in the early hours of Sunday the 23rd of June, these are our main stories. President Trump says the United States is pressing ahead with additional sanctions on Iran to stop it from developing a nuclear weapon, but military action is still on the table. Officials in Ethiopia say there has been a violent attempt to seize control of the regional government in Amhara, and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said far-right extremism must be tackled, even if it means breaking political taboos. Also in this podcast... We delve into the sounds of Mongolian throat singing by the heavy metal group The Who. President Trump says the US plans to impose additional sanctions on Iran as tensions between the two countries escalate. He told reporters the aim was to stop the Iranians acquiring a nuclear bomb.
If Iran wants to become a wealthy nation again, become a prosperous nation, we'll call it Let's Make Iran Great Again. Yeah, it's okay with me. But they're never going to do it if they think in 5 or 6 years they're going to have a nuclear weapon. I know too much about nuclear, a lot about nuclear, and let me just tell you, they're not going to have a nuclear weapon.
Tehran recently said it intended to breach an agreement limit on its stockpile of enriched uranium. The president called off a planned US military attack on Thursday night, which would have been defended as retaliation for the shooting down of an American drone aircraft. But he says military action remains a possibility. So can this crisis be resolved? Jarrett Blanc is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was previously US State Department coordinator for the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, known by its acronym JCPOA. That included the lifting of US sanctions before President Trump pulled out of the deal last year. Lise Doucette asked him what he makes of what's now called the maximum pressure approach, which includes a call for Iran to return to the negotiating table.
I don't think that we have to predict. We can see how it's not working. The Iranian government feels as though it's backed into a corner. There is no credible negotiating partner on the other side. The United States sends mixed signals and seems to be insisting on things that Iran can't realistically give up without threatening their own perceived regime stability. And so they're finding other ways to react rather than to risk a negotiation with the United States that would probably end politically badly at the very least for whichever Iranian official sponsored it.
So there are two ways forward. One is to keep ratcheting up the pressure and to go for a military response, which at least this week President Trump backed away from. The other track is to try to find ways to de-escalate, because everyone says they don't want a war. If they were going to try to de-escalate, what would be the next step, do you think?
Well, I think the first and most important thing that the United States would need to do to de-escalate is just to reduce the prospect of an accidental military contact in the Gulf region. And so that means not rushing all of these additional forces to the Gulf. It means stepping back a little bit, even some of the normal surveillance activities that the United States might do. And I think hopefully it means other countries stepping in to address what are genuine regional security concerns, freedom of navigation concerns. You've seen a little bit of that already with the Indian Navy dispatching a group to the Gulf of Oman to provide security for India-bound commerce. I think if other countries were to step in with a sort of modest coordinated response along those lines, it would diminish at least the prospect of an accidental fight between the United States and Iran. And then after that, it's really a matter, I think, of trying to find a way to enable peacemakers to do some work. And certainly that's not finding new sanctions on Iran. It's maybe lifting some of the sanctions that the Trump administration has imposed, or at least finding softer implementation measures to incentivize talks.
Now, let's look at the space for diplomacy. The impression is that there are messages going back and forth conveyed through Arab and Western diplomats, but there doesn't seem to be evidence of an American attempt to start establishing a channel of some kind. What's your impression?
I think that that's exactly right. And I also think that there is too much focus on this almost logistical question of how do you pass messages back and forth. The problem is not that the United States and Iran don't have ways to communicate. I mean, it would be better if we had had direct communication, but the Japanese, the Omanis, the Europeans, there are a variety of ways to pass messages. The problem is that the United States is passing trivial and unimportant messages. So Prime Minister Abe gets asked to go to Tehran in order to deliver really nothing more than an invitation to talk on the margins of the UN General Assembly in September, an offer that's been repeatedly rejected by the Iranian side. There's got to be more substance and something more that actually draws the Iranians into a discussion that, as I said, poses dramatic domestic political risks for whoever would argue the point in Tehran.
But is it the case that the leading members of President Trump's team, including the National Security Advisor John Bolton and the Secretary of State Pompeo, aren't really interested in a diplomatic channel, and the State Department has been so hollowed out that it doesn't have the ability to actually to start to establish one?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that the president has surrounded himself not by diplomats, but by arsonists, and they are showing their stripes in this escalating crisis.
Jarrett Blanc, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Away from the military planners, Iranians already talk about another kind of war, an economic war fueled by wave after wave of crippling sanctions imposed by the US since it pulled out of the landmark nuclear deal last year. What is daily life like now? Ghanbar Naderi is a journalist in Tehran.
Just put yourself in the shoes of an average family here in the capital, a middle-class family that wants to send their kids abroad to study. They need to send money too, but they cannot send it because we have been cut off from the SWIFT system. What they have to do is find the middleman to do that. So that means they are going to pay extra cash to send like $1,000 or $2,000 to their kids. These are simple things that have become a huge struggle for many middle-class families.
And if you walk down one of what would be one of the busiest streets in Tehran, with the shops, the markets, which are known to be bustling. What does it look like, feel like now?
Well, Liz, you cannot talk to people these days. People are angry. Obviously, they cannot make ends meet. And you need to work in more than one or two places to pay your bills. So when you are stuck in traffic, when you are doing a simple visit to your local shop or bakery, You immediately notice that people are angry. They are not talking to each other. They are not communicating because it's obvious that they are going through some kind of financial struggles. And that is the feeling here. So it's not a good time to go shopping because not many people are shopping these days. Yes, there are some people that are well off, but that's only 1 or 2%, or maybe 3%, or maybe 10% if you are very optimistic. But above that, it's not good news. I mean, I'm afraid that they cannot pay their rent. They cannot pay their bills. They are in debt. They cannot pay their banking loans. They cannot get even loans because the banking system here is very unfair. If you are good, if you are making money, they give you loans. But if you are a simple salaryman, as the Japanese say, they don't give you any loans.
If you go to the pharmacy, what medicines are available and what ones are simply not on the shelves anymore?
The medical system here is a big mafia. And if you want to have a small, surgery, you have to pay under the table to your physician in order to jump the queue and have that crucial surgery or operation. And that's not what many people are able to do because the corruption here has affected everything, even the medical system here. So if you want to have access to like medicines like cancer, many people just simply die because they cannot afford the exorbitant expenses.
What is it like compared to Tehran in the provinces where people may have always lived more simply? Do they still suffer under the weight of sanctions?
I'm a reporter. All the time I'm traveling to the provinces and I'm not happy with what I see. All the governments so far over the past 40 years have always tried to concentrate their efforts in the capital. So they have overlooked the basic needs of those who are living in provinces. I mean, I covered the stories of the flooding about the March 22 this year. And people were anyway, they were in poverty. But the floodings was the last nail in the coffin of their livelihoods. I mean, just think about it. We are under sanctions. These are poverty-stricken areas. They are underdeveloped. And then suddenly you have flooding. It is going to be devastating for your family. And I was very upset because it was hundreds of villages, rural areas that had been affected by flooding. And let's face it, even a government, a rich government, cannot just fix things overnight. And then we have the sanctions regime. I mean, it's just hopeless.
Ghanbar Naderi in Tehran talking to Lise Doucette. Meanwhile, Britain's Foreign Office will send one of its ministers to Iran on Sunday to call for an urgent de-escalation of regional tensions. The situation also has a bearing on the case of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, the British-Iranian woman who remains imprisoned in Iran on spying charges. Both she and her husband are currently on hunger strike in protest over her treatment. The BBC spoke to Richard Ratcliffe on Saturday, 8 days into his hunger strike outside the Iranian embassy in London.
Certainly increased tensions are never good for us. Certainly we watch the news closely and we would be worried if things get too far. So I'm certainly glad that the minister has gone over and will be trying to lobby both for de-escalation of tensions and also a chance for him to talk about Nazanin's case. In terms of her conditions, she's still where she was. So she's still in the general ward with the women. Some of the other women are looking after her and checking she's OK. And certainly the prison clinic is beginning to worry quite closely and keeps checking on her. And she was off to see the head of the prison clinic earlier on today. And they keep wanting to put her on a drip, which so far she's refused to do. I think she's waiting to see what response there is from the Iranian authorities. There hasn't been one today, but tomorrow there might well be. Day 8 is getting a bit tough. I'm as you can see, I'm sitting down. I'm getting tireder and slower of thinking. Not hungry, oddly, but I think it's of a gradual deterioration of being able to operate. But so far I'm able to keep strong.
Richard Ratcliffe. Now to other news. Ethiopian officials say there has been a violent attempt to seize control of a regional government authority. The country has experienced a wave of ethnic unrest in recent months. David Bamford reports.
The press secretary of Abiy Ahmed, Ethiopia's reformist prime minister, told national television that what he called a coup attempt in Amhara region had failed. Residents have spoken of a heavy exchange of gunfire on Saturday afternoon around the police headquarters in the regional capital. Media reports also say there was a failed attempt to kill Amhara's governor, who is loyal to the prime minister. There are no details of casualties or who was behind the attack. Federal troops have been deployed.
David Bamford. A fight without taboos against right-wing extremists. That's what the German Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced 3 weeks after one of her CDU party's local politicians was murdered, allegedly by a man with connections to neo-Nazis. Mrs. Merkel made her statement on Saturday at a church gathering in the western city of Dortmund.
This must be tackled at its roots and with no limits. Otherwise, we'll have a complete loss of credibility. And this is obviously the opposite of what we need, trust. This is why this is a challenge for the state at all levels. And the federal government is taking this very, very seriously.
I asked our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders, what the Chancellor meant with the phrase without taboos.
Well, as usual, Mrs. Merkel isn't entirely specific on that kind of phrase, but what I think she's most likely to mean is the suggestion by the Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, among others, that people who spread hate speech could have their basic democratic rights taken away from them. That could mean the right to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, even in extreme cases, the right to vote. It's a suggestion that's also made by Peter Tauber, who was a former Secretary General of the governing Christian Democrats. He even hinted that it could be applied to people in the opposition Alternative for Germany party, people like Alice Weidel, which, of course, has caused quite a stir.
Is that something he can actually do? Does he have the power to do that, or does he have to push on the courts for something like that?
He would have to push to the courts. Under Article 18 of the German Basic Law, you would have to apply to the Constitutional Court to get that kind of right taken away. And it's certainly not going to be very easy to do that. It's not a concrete proposal at the moment, but it is clearly being seriously considered when heavyweights like Mrs. Merkel and Horst Seehofer are mentioning it.
Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders. Staying in Germany, and hundreds of climate change protesters have stormed an open-cast coal mine in the west of the country during a weekend of campaigning against fossil fuels. They ran through a police cordon after gathering at the Garzweiler mine early on Saturday. Local residents worried about plans to expand the pit were joined by teenage activists. This protester explained why they'd taken action.
What we want to achieve is to phase out coal as quickly as possible to save what there still is to be saved from this world.
Police had cautioned that the colliery wasn't safe to enter and warned of possible legal action against trespassers. They said some officers were injured while trying to hold back the demonstrators. Recent surveys have suggested that climate change tops a list of concerns in Germany, with the Green Party polling alongside the governing Christian Democrats. Pakistan is one of three countries in the world where polio remains prevalent. That's partly because the public are very suspicious of the polio vaccine due to decades of conspiracy theories, religious indoctrination and hysteria. Vaccination teams in the field often face hostility as part of their door-to-door campaigns. Shumaila Jaffrey has been following health teams involved in Pakistan's polio programme, starting in the city of Rawalpindi.
It's early morning, and some 24 women are gathered at a health clinic in Rawalpindi. Their faces are veiled, and they wear bright yellow cards with their names and words, Pakistan Polio Programme, written on them. Standing at a rostrum, Dr. Uzma Hayat Khan briefs the women before they head out to give polio drops to 5,000 children who live in the area. She's interrupted by one who says almost all parents had refused vaccine the day before. Another says they were harassed by parents, accusing them of poisoning their children. Dr. Uzma works with polio field teams on how to counter the suspicion they meet.
It can be any rumor or myth that it's a government plot and that they are giving birth control medicine in the guise of the polio vaccine. Sometimes the parents fear the vaccine contains forbidden ingredients, so they refuse the polio drops. More than 1,000 kilometers away in the southern city of Karachi, Ibrar Khan walks cautiously on his prosthetic legs, leaning heavily on crutches. He's a volunteer who caught polio as a child and is desperate to stop the spread of the disease in his community.
The number of refusals should have dropped. The way the polio program has involved religious personalities in it, the way it is running awareness campaigns about vaccinations, but refusals are still shooting up.
Ibrar is part of a door-to-door vaccination campaign which first began in 2000. The Taliban banned it from the areas under its control, arguing it was a Western plot to sterilize Muslims. Recent scenes shown live on local TV in Peshawar in the northwest of the country underline just how much work is still to be done. The TV cameras caught angry parents attacking a government health facility, kicking the gate down and setting it ablaze. Their children had the polio vaccination at school, but the headmaster had rung parents to say they were fainting and vomiting. Dozens of students were taken to hospital. Almost all of them were found to be perfectly well and discharged, but not before panic spread via social media. Polio officials like Babar bin Atta believe the government must be quicker to answer parents' questions if the polio program is to eventually succeed.
Shumaila Jaffrey reporting from Pakistan. Also in the podcast,
we've never really been truly recognised as Caribbean people. So having a Windrush monument will be the idea of saying, yes, we appreciate you.
The UK marks the first National Windrush Day, which celebrates the contribution of Caribbean migrants to British culture. In Britain, the two contenders to replace Theresa May as Prime Minister have made their first pitch for the job at a meeting of Conservative Party members in Birmingham in central England. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt laid out their visions for the country. But Mr Johnson ducked questions about why police were called to his girlfriend's flat on Thursday night following reports of a heated argument. Our political correspondent Jonathan Blake listened to the first round of the leadership hustings.
In his opening pitch, full of characteristically optimistic rhetoric, Boris Johnson told the audience that although these were dark days, the hour was darkest before dawn, and he was the man to be unleashed to deliver Brexit. Before he could elaborate on his plan and policies, the elephant in the room was addressed. The event's host, Ian Dale, asked Mr Johnson why police were called to his flat on Thursday night.
I think Boris, most people would really rather judge my ambitions and my character and my programme by what I deliver.
What they want to know is...
Mr Johnson avoided the issue, and at least some in the audience seemed to agree with his approach.
So just to be clear, you're not going to make any comment at all on what happened last night?
I think that's pretty obvious from the foregoing, Ian. But I...
When the discussion moved on, Boris Johnson said that his priorities as Prime Minister would be increasing education funding, boosting fibre broadband coverage and delivering Brexit. He was asked again if he would guarantee to take the UK out of the EU on October the 31st with or without a deal.
Eminently feasible means it's not only that we are going to do it, but it's possible. To do it because it's eminently feasible.
But will you do it?
Of course we can do it.
No, I know we can do it.
That's the spirit.
But will we
hold
do it?
That thought?
Mr. Johnson suggested he'd increase police numbers and said a ruthless campaign was needed to crack down on drugs gangs. He said his infamous F-Business comment was a stray remark referring to lobby groups who wanted a certain type of Brexit. There was more talk of cutting income tax for middle earners, as he put it, and lifting the lowest paid further out of tax. But on that and other policies, there were few specific promises. Jeremy Hunt again described himself as the underdog, but said he was better placed to negotiate a Brexit deal.
We've had a lot of discussion about how we Brexit, but not enough discussion about who. Who is the Prime Minister we trust to send to Brussels and lead us out of this crisis? And we send the wrong person. Catastrophe awaits.
Mr. Hunt said he would allow a no-deal Brexit if need be with a heavy heart, but wouldn't guarantee leaving by the end of October because it's possible that Parliament could prevent that.
My judgment is that weighing those difficult options up, the political risk of no Brexit is far worse than the economic risk of no deal. And I would take us out of the European Union in that situation.
But it wouldn't be 100%,
but it would not be my choice. If we can avoid it, if we can get a deal, that is something that a responsible Prime Minister should aim for.
Okay.
Jeremy Hunt countered a suggestion that he was too polite to negotiate effectively with the EU by saying that he shouldn't be underestimated. He defended his record as health secretary, during which junior doctors went on strike over a new pay deal, saying he was proud of the NHS and that he had had to fight some very tough battles.
Our political correspondent, Jonathan Blake. Turkey's biggest city, Istanbul, is voting to elect a mayor later on Sunday in a contest widely seen as a referendum on President Erdogan. The poll is a rerun of the one held in March, which was narrowly won by the opposition, but annulled after government claims of irregularities. Mr. Erdogan had pushed for the new vote, but as our Istanbul correspondent Mark Lowen reports, it's a risky strategy.
Turkey's most powerful leader in its modern history doesn't take defeat easily. And when his party lost his home city of Istanbul, which he once ran as mayor, he cried foul. The election board was believed to have buckled under pressure, ordering a rerun. But it's a gamble that could backfire. The opposition candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu has seized on the widespread desire for change in this polarized, angry country with his optimistic message, "Everything will be fine." If Mr. Erdogan's candidate, the former Prime Minister Binali Yildirim, loses, there will be those asking if it's the beginning of the president's end. Mr. Erdogan has made this an intensely personal contest. He's framed it as a matter of survival. But with a spluttering economy, inflation is at almost 20% and the Turkish lira has slid by a third over the last year, and doubts over the validity of the rerun, some of his usually loyal voters are expected to switch sides. Victory in the election would secure President Erdogan's hold over Turkey, but a loss, particularly by a larger margin than in March, would hasten splits within his own party and speculation over the post-Erdogan era.
Mark Lowen. Events took place on Saturday across the UK to mark the first National Windrush Day, which celebrates the contribution of Caribbean migrants to British culture. It's more than 70 years since the first of the so-called Windrush generation arrived by ship to help rebuild Britain after the Second World War. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, announced that a Windrush memorial will be created at London's Waterloo Station.
In the 1950s and 60s, the station was where many people from the Caribbean arrived in London after docking at Southampton, and a place to which those who had already made the crossing would flock in search of friends and relatives. Today, millions of people from around the world pass through the station each year, and the new memorial will remind each of them of the tremendous debt our country owes to the Windrush generation.
The former TV presenter, Floella Benjamin, now Lady Benjamin, has been calling for such a monument for a long time.
I feel as if I've been embraced through my play school babies when I did play school, making my contribution. And there are hundreds of people like me who have done the same. But we've never really been truly recognised as Caribbean people. So having a Windrush monument will be the idea of saying, yes, we appreciate you. You do belong to Britain. You're entwined in British society now, in British history, in a way that we're all recognising.
But the memorial has attracted criticism from some campaigners who are calling for changes to the UK's immigration laws. Karen Doyle is the national organiser for the Windrush pressure group Movement for Justice.
While the arrival of the Windrush and that important generation absolutely need to be celebrated, coming from this government, creating a gesture out of steel and bronze when there are still people destitute, facing hardship, and their descendants and family members facing detention and deportation, it's a bit of an empty gesture.
Karen Doyle. Now, have a listen to this. What do you get if you combine the following musical styles? We just heard the seemingly disparate sounds of Mongolian throat singing, followed by heavy metal stars Iron Maiden. Well, the answer is that it sounds something like this. That's the sound of the Mongolian heavy metal group The Who. The band, which gets its name from the root word for human being, blends Mongolian folk music with heavy metal, which is an unlikely sounding combination. They refer to it as Hanu Rock. The Who are currently on their first tour outside Mongolia and have swapped their native Ulaanbaatar, the Mongolian capital, for towns and cities across Europe. They performed in Oslo on Friday night and will be in Germany on Sunday. Our correspondent Paul Henley spoke via an interpreter to Gala, The Who's lead throat singer and horsehead fiddle player, asking him to best describe the band's sound.
You know, the Hmong thing,
it's a new style, and we call this style Hunu Rock. It is a mix of Mongolian traditional music and the Western rock music.
Why the combination with heavy metal? It's unusual.
It's all started with our producer Dashka 8 years ago when he was visiting his father's birthplace. Then he got this idea, we should try to combine like Mongolian traditional throat singing with the rock music. The place where his father is from, the Hod Amek Chandmanso, it's a place in Mongolia, is the birthplace of throat singing.
How would you describe throat singing? Maybe you could give us a quick demonstration, because it's a very individual sound, isn't it? It literally comes from the back of your throat, I suppose.
Humi is the vocal technique that come down from our ancestors to us, and it started as a person trying to sound like wind or water, and it's a way of communicating to the nature. There's like two types.
What kind of reaction are you getting to your music in the rock festivals that you're performing at in Europe?
We are so honored and humbled by the reactions of the people in Europe. And we are just so happy that these fans are just waiting for us. You know, like even before getting on the stage, there's like thousands of people chanting like, who, as if they were waiting for us for years.
The appeal of your music is actually quite immediate to a Western audience. Do you think you've compromised from the pure form of Mongolian folk music that you've come from to make it more palatable for Western ears?
There is no compromise. We're keeping the old thing and making it richer, and we wanted to share it with everybody in the world.
Gala from the Mongolian heavy metal group The Who. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can of course send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Chris Barrow, and until next time, goodbye.
An unidentified body in a remote Norwegian valley.
She was laying with the head down there.
Who was she?
Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
And what was she doing there?
She has an agenda and she doesn't want to talk about it.
I'm Marit Tegraf.
And I'm Neil McCarthy. And in Death in Ice Valley, we tried to find answers to a mystery that has remained unsolved for 48 years.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
Tracking down eyewitnesses and using new forensic technology.
Now I'm cutting the tooth.
Telling a story set deep in the Cold War with strong hints of espionage.
If you take the missile, I will shoot.
But it left us with a lingering feeling that someone didn't want the truth to be known.
Obviously, he was told by some people to keep his mouth shut.
We're about to come back with an update, so now's the perfect time to catch up with the whole series.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
What on earth happened that day?
That's Death in Ice Valley from the BBC World Service and NRK.
I think we'll break this case right now.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you get your podcasts.